Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today on the first day of the Surface Navy Association's 33rd annual conference, this year presented virtually, is United States Navy Vice Admiral Bill Galinas, the commander of the Naval Sea Systems Command. We are an SNA media partner, and our coverage is sponsored by Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, Leonardo DRS, and General Electric Marine. And it's my honor to welcome Vice Admiral Bill Galinas, the commander of the Naval Sea Systems Command, to the program on this first day of our Surface Navy Association coverage. Admiral Galinas, Happy New Year, and thanks so very much for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks, Vago. Happy New Year to you. And again, I really appreciate your time and the opportunity to spend a few minutes with you here this afternoon and just kind of talk through a couple of things that we're working on here at NAVC and across the Navy.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. I think, sir, you had certainly one of the most interesting commands out which the Navy wouldn't be able to operate. Hondo Gertz, the Navy acquisition executive, has been very open and communicated with reporters consistently throughout this whole COVID process. And he's always noted that the Navy, despite the tragedy of COVID, the Navy has used this as an opportunity to better prepare for future crises while also operating not just more efficiently, but more effectively. How has COVID changed how your command is operating?
Yeah, I tell you, Vago, it's changed in a number of different ways. So I'll start just here at headquarters. And, you know, probably like many organizations, many commands across the Navy, and really, frankly, across industry as well, you know, we went into a telework, you know, environment, a distributed work environment, you know, back in the mid-March timeframe, excuse me, when COVID hit, and, you know, have really kind of maintained that over the last 9 months or so. And so, you know, really kind of leveraging the IT systems and, you know, again, credit to the, you know, the folks over in N2, N6 and our IT shipmates out there have really kind of stepped up, you know, good stability on the IT systems. A lot of use of video conferencing and whatnot. And, you know, off and on averaging probably just around 20% of the workforce coming into the building here inside the Washington Navy Yard on any given day. It's probably a little bit higher in some parts of our organization. So I'd say, you know, principally like in the program offices and our engineering directorate, you know, and maybe a little bit more of the distributed work environment in finance and contracts and organizations like that. So that's probably been the biggest change here in the headquarters building. You know, we're seeing similar things at some of our field activities where people can telework and, you know, working in accordance with the state guidelines that have been put out. It's principally in the shipyards and really our industrial activities is where we have, you know, really probably learned a lot of the lessons on how we bring people in to an industrial environment and have them work in a safe manner over an extended period of time. And what I would tell you is for the four naval shipyards, really since, you know, since March, we went into the telework when the COVID pandemic hit in March, we saw a fairly significant dip in workforce participation of folks coming into the yard, like many other industrial activities, probably down to, you know, the 50-60% range. But then probably I'll say since, you know, late May, June timeframe, for the most part on the production workforce in the shipyards, we've been in the 88-86% range in terms of, you know, folks on site every day. And, you know, that's compared to maybe on a normal day in the 93-95% range when you account for vacation and training and things of that nature. So that's kind of gives you an idea of kind of the impact that we've seen overall. So I think we've steadied out at a fairly good, you know, fairly reasonable place there. Things that we've found that have really worked to kind of allow us to maintain that level of participation. are the things we talk about every day, right? So, you know, wearing a face mask is important, especially, you know, in a shipyard where you're working generally in close quarters on a ship, in a shop, whatever it might be. You know, wearing a mask is important. Where we can, we do try to maintain the 6 foot distance. As I mentioned, though, that's not always possible. And then, right. You know, the hygiene protocols that we've all been come to know so well. So, you know, we found that's worked for us pretty well. I will tell you, again, just like the rest of the country, we've started to see the numbers come up here in the December timeframe. We're watching that closely. We'll see what happens here as we turn the page into 2021. But I would tell you overall, just across, a workforce of about 80,000 people, we've had just under 4,100 cases of people test positive for COVID. So, just probably below or just right around that 5% range, I think, in terms of positive cases. And we find that most of those, quite frankly, occurred outside of the work environment. So a lot of credit to our field commanders, especially our shipyard COs who really, I think, and their leadership teams that have done a really, really good job, inside our public shipyards, keeping the workforce safe and keeping the production work going.
What are some of the permanent changes, right? I mean, you accepted a submarine with one person, right? So inspection teams are smaller, or acceptance teams are smaller. What are some of the permanent changes you guys are making? Because your charge and charter, or your priority, I should say, is delivering capability, without overusing a phrase, right? Better, faster, and cheaper, whether it's for new construction or whether it's for delivering fleet maintenance. Talk to us about some of those permanent changes you're making and how that they tie into your vision on the new construction side of getting ships out that are of higher quality, are hitting cost and hitting your schedule targets.
In terms of the permanent changes, where we can execute different efforts with fewer people. And we always balance that with, making sure that we get the work done correctly and safely with maybe a smaller workforce in place. Telework is going to continue to be a significant part. We have found that we've been able to, execute many parts of our mission without the level of travel that we've had in the past. Although I will tell you that that some of that does need to return. And it just, I do think, presence is a force multiplier. And so, there are times we do need to get folks, out to our industry counterparts for different engagements, and then really out to the fleet concentration areas. So those are a couple of the more significant things. One thing that I think we have seen, working with the type commanders and the fleet commanders, and this is a positive thing, is we've seen, an increase in self-sufficiency on the part of many of our deployed ships and platforms. And by that, what I mean is, kind of increased use of long distance support and, to troubleshoot systems where, maybe in the past we would have, sent a technician out to kind of work with ships for. So I think that's a positive trend. It's something we're looking at very closely to, see how we can kind of leverage that.
Let me ask you about fleet maintenance. You mentioned that, and obviously all of these distance support measures are things that in a future crisis would hold the Navy in good stead. But one of the big challenges is, even though we have aspirations for 400 ships, we have about 300 ships, operational demands are high, and yet our shipyard capacities are limited. And anytime there is a ship that overruns in availability, that has a tendency of having disruptive events. Several generations of your predecessors have made a priority. There are optimization plans. There's investment in shipyards. There's hiring of more people. And yet we still have an overwhelming backlog of ship maintenance. And sometimes when ships get to the fleet, sailors complain about the ships not being fully completed, having to work hard to get ready for, or harder than ever to get ready for deployment. Talk to us a little bit about whether and how you're changing this model to be able to deliver capability, to get ships through availability faster, and whether we need more private and government capacity. I mean, what are the things for us to be able to change this paradigm? Because we've been struggling with this for some time, and we still have overwhelming backlog rates.
Thanks. That's a great question. And, you know, there's no easy answer to that. We would have fixed this a while ago. But let me break your question up in a couple of different parts. And I'll start, with the private sector first and then talk about the public sector. The private sector, as you know, is where we do all of our surface maintenance work. And, there is a number of initiatives that, have been started up to this point and some newer ones that we're implementing going forward. But I would tell you the number one driver in ships staying in availabilities long is unplanned work. And that manifests itself in a number of ways. And it's work that we either don't get into the package up front. It's work that we discover during the availability while the ship is being maintained. It comes about in a number of different ways. So, kind of a focus on the planning, and there's been a tremendous effort really over the last couple of years to get that right. And I think we're starting to see that bear fruit, the planning efforts to really get to a more stable plan. So I think that's going to help. And that plan, it really consists of three parts. It's the kind of the ship modernization work, which keeps our ships combat relevant as they go through their service life. And it's the upgrade or the installation of new systems, new capability on the ships during these major availabilities. The second part is what we refer to as the directed maintenance. So this is this is work that you need to do on a ship, that the deep maintenance that's required on board a ship on a periodic basis. It's kind of like that that maintenance manual that's in the glove box of your car that tells you to change the oil every 5,000 miles or so, right? So, and we know that, tanks need to be coated on a certain periodicity, that shafts need to be refurbished on a certain periodicity. And so, that directed maintenance that we can, it's planned, it's repeatable, it's generally consistent. Making that really kind of a larger percentage of the availability. And then the third part of the work package is the things that just they break, right? So it's fixing the air conditioning unit. It's replacing or fixing that air compressor. It just repairs that we have to do on the ship just over the course of the life of the ship. But the more work that we can get stable and planned up front. So this directed maintenance package that I talked about, that's, we're trying to grow the percentage of that work in an availability. From right now, it's about 45 or 50% of the package. We'd like to see that get, up in the 60 to 70% range if possible. And so, as we do that, we can take care of some of those repairs and try to minimize that work up front. So that's a key piece to trying to minimize that unplanned work that I was talking about. The other thing that we've taken a real hard look at and we're seeing some really good progress on is the ordering and procurement of material before an availability starts. And so, there's generally, and again, in a couple different batches of material, there's the long lead material. So these are items that we would order for an availability months or in some cases years before an availability starts. And so, that's an effort that the government needs to do, because obviously we don't have a contract in place to do that. So, we've improved that process. And then as we get closer to the availability, And we get the contract awarded, the opportunity to give the contract, once we award that contractor, to give the contractor time to order the material that they need to start the availability. So, we've seen over the last, I'll say, year to 18 months, we've seen the material availability at the start of an available at a maintenance availability, the percentage just increase. And so we're getting now, much higher percentage of material delivered and in the shipyard before we start an availability. So that's helped us tremendously. So we've gone, you know, again, from the 50-60% range. Now we're consistently probably, north of 90% in terms of material available when an availability starts. And then the third thing that I would talk about really is when we award that contract. And so, in the type of contract structure that we have with our private shipyards, the fixed price contracts, we've made a move to award that contract 4 months, or what we refer to as 120 days before an availability starts. And that's, we've been pulling that slowly, pulling that time frame, that duration back, to give the contractor more time to, order that material that I just talked about, to get his subcontractors in place, to get what's really critical, to get his integrated master schedule in place and really get the work plan, get it sequenced properly. We've still got some more work to do there in terms of some of the installation teams that we bring on board, and maybe some of the government efforts that take place, give them an opportunity to do that. But, giving them, it makes a significant difference when they have 4 months to do that work, as opposed to maybe a month or two before an availability starts. So, and then once we get into execution, so then it's all about, again, with the focus of that unplanned work, how do you minimize that? Or when you identify it, how do you quickly get it on contract? And so, I talked about the directed maintenance piece. It's important, a number of jobs, maybe we don't, we've tried to minimize the number of open, what we call open and inspect items, where you take a piece of equipment apart, you inspect the internals, and you make repairs based on what you find. What we've tried to transition more to is just what we call go fix it type work, right? So instead of open and inspecting a piece of equipment, just go in. We have kind of an engineered, work package for that particular component. We just know we've got to go do that. We can order the material up front. The shipyard can plan that work, and it just makes it more efficient, and it reduces any unknown work. So, trying to get all that work done up front has been helpful. And then it really comes down to execution. And again, working with the shipyards, and that's kind of the work that we're doing right now. So that's the private sector, but a lot of work done on the upfront, on the planning, the material procurement, and the contract award piece. On the public sector side, same principles apply. The major driver for driving availability is long is typically unplanned work. So, we have a fairly significant ongoing right now to really take a look at class maintenance plans and how much work we're putting into these submarine and carrier, availabilities, and really looking at, do we have a good plan going into the shipyard for a particular submarine or carrier availability. Now, we don't have the contracting approach that we have with the private sector, because obviously the work is done in a naval shipyard, but there's still a heavy emphasis on planning and getting that planning right. And I think there's probably still some work that we need to do. We're probably not as far along on the public sector side as we are on the private sector side there, to get that done. And so, so those are some of the things that we're working on. The other piece, within the public sector, is really just, again, looking at the efficiency of the workforce and what requirements have we over time levied on the workforce that when you start to stack up these requirements, really kind of contribute to some of the, some of the challenges and some of the inefficiencies that the workforce is faced with, that the shipyards are faced with, because we've really just, kind of stack those requirements on top of the shipyard over a period of time. And so there's an ongoing effort right now, led by the vice chief of naval operation, the performance to plan effort that you've heard, that we've really taken a look at these avail durations. We're looking at where our inefficiencies are across the different shops, different parts of the shipyard. And then we've also brought in another team to kind of help us look at, know, how do we get through where we identify these efficiencies? What's the best way to kind of work our way through that? So
let me ask you about the Constellation class. You were the PEO, you were the program manager for the LPD-17. You were also PEO ships. So I have an enormous amount of experience in bringing capability into the fleet. The Constellation class frigate is the biggest frigate we've ever built. It's bigger than a destroyer in many respects. And it is going to be a leap ahead in terms of reduced operating cost, more sort of consistency. What are the lessons from all the ship programs that we've had that have come before it that have been somewhat more problematic? And that includes LPD-17 and includes LCS that are going into this ship to make sure that it is delivered on time with a lower operating cost as planned, and as well on schedule, given how vital it is to bring new construction on schedule and cost, given the Navy doesn't have a lot of flexibility in its budget, especially given its operational demands.
I'll start off just with a concept, evolutionary design versus revolutionary design, right? And so, you know, the platform, the ship, if you will, you know, that should be an evolutionary approach, right? Your technical risk should not really be in the platform, right? If you're going to take risk, you know, where you really want your revolutionary capability to come from is your combat system, your combat capability, right? And so, on the frigate design, we're, and it really is, the frigate is really kind of a really, really good example of an evolutionary approach where, frankly, you know, the program office has used a parent design, the FREM frigate, which has got a lot of history. A number of those have been built and been put to sea. So the hull form and whatnot is it's a proven design. We know how to build it. So that part of it is proven. That being said, you know, there are some changes that the U.S. Navy has made to the platform, in terms of some of the internal machinery, okay, components and whatnot, the diesel generators and whatnot. So, there's maybe a little bit of risk in that perspective. But that's really that's system integration risk. Okay. It's not really kind of construction. I mean, even the propulsion plant, you know, it's the same propulsion plant, maybe a few different components, right? One of the things that the PEO and the program office are looking at right now is to mitigate that integration risk that I mentioned, is looking at possibly, building a land-based engineering test site for the propulsion plant. Okay. And they're going through a number of options on how to do that. But, you know, where we have done that in the past, okay, and think DDG 51, for example, if you go to the Warfare Center up in Philadelphia right now, you know, there's a DDG 51 plant up there, okay, on the electrical side, I'm talking about where, you know, we've proved that out. And in fact, we're using that very same concept on the Flight 3s, so the DDG 51 Flight 3s that we're building today, right, where we have the one of the big differences going from the Flight 2As to the Flight 3s was a change in the electrical plant. So we built that different electrical plant up in Philadelphia, and we're going through those integration tests right now. So we're following kind of the same model on the frigate. And so that's how we're going to get after, you know, we've got a proven hull form. We've got a proven propulsion plant. We've changed some of the components. So we're going to go through, some integration testing to mitigate that integration risk. And then when you start looking at the combat system, we're really leveraging a lot of what we're doing on the DDG 51 flight threes, right? So, we are using the AMDR. Okay. The SPY 6 with the Aegis Baseline 10 combat system. Okay. So, you know, by the time we get that, we will have rung that out, and we're testing that today at the Lockheed Martin plant, doing that land-based testing today on the flight 3 combat system. And so that risk will then kind of, we'll mitigate that risk that way. By the time we start this, we'll be well into the DDG 51 flight 3. Now the AMDR radar on the frigate, it's a little bit different, right? We're using smaller radar modules. But the concept of the radar itself is generally the same. The integration with the combat system is generally the same. On the C4I systems, again, leveraging a lot of the same C4I systems that we have on the DDG 51 Flight 2A and the Flight 3. So I think we're on track for a good good outcome with the frigate program.
You know, one of the points that Rick Hunt made was the consistency that once we lock in the design for these 10 ships, they're going to be the same without modifications on each ship, which drive cost, right? So that's going to be another key element where you can get that configuration control to it, get these decisions, have the hard conversations first, and then you get a better run rate as opposed to each ship or each two ships being different from the others.
You know, that's exactly right. So I mentioned, you know, on the maintenance side, you know, the enemy of getting ships out of the yards on time is unplanned work. You know, in new construction, it's change, right? And so, you know, if you can give a shipyard, you know, consistent and repeatable work, I guarantee the outcome will be much better than if you're making a number of changes during the construction phase and everything. You know, I mean, there's going to be some of that. As we put this ship together, but I think the approach that's being taken, the strategy that's being put in place, really attempts to mitigate that change and really does give the program a much better opportunity for a successful outcome on that program.
Let me ask you, since it's SNA, LCS, the Littoral Combat Ship, always looms large in each one of these conversations. 32 ship acquisition, 21, 23, and I think 22 and 24 are going to be delivered over the course of this year, which is a great rate. But many people in the fleet are asking, sir, when are we going to get the mission modules? When is this ship, which are the core of the ship's capability? And a lot of people are still asking, like, how do we get into a situation where we now have, you know, two dozen of these ships that aren't really equipped with the modules that give them the kind of capability we need at the end of the day? You know, how did we end up getting to where we are? But what's the sort of clear path to get the capability out to sailors and to commanders out there that could use that capability, and that capability is going to be key for the future Navy operational planning?
Yeah, I think what I would tell you is I think the PEO and the program really kind of turned the corner here in the last year or so. I think we're seeing a significant increase in the lethality of the littoral combat ships. The surface warfare mission package that is now being deployed has matured. It includes a surface-to-surface missile module, okay, that was initially put on the USS Jackson here just this past year. And so, you know, I think we're starting to see that stability and the maturity of the mission modules, you know, really kind of work itself out. And I think we're starting to see the real delivery here in 2021. And I really think that, that path, or that program rather, has really kind of turned the corner. The design is stable. Frankly, we've still got, some challenges with reliability on specific systems, namely kind of the water jets. We're coming through an issue with the combining gear on the LCS-1 variant. But I think we're getting through that. We've got a path forward on that. The team has done a lot of work specifically on the reduction or the combining gear over the last several months. So we've got a path forward on that. So I think we're going to start to see this platform really come into its own. When it's all said and done, we'll have 35 of these ships in the fleet. There's some really, really good capability out there. And I'm pretty confident in where the team is going and the work that the PEO are doing with our engineering director at CO5 to get after some of these nagging technical issues.
Let me ask you two questions. One is a submarine question. I know it's SNA, but it's a good opportunity to ask you this. The Columbia program is the highest priority program in the Navy, and we've seen steady schedule slips and added cost. And at the end of the day, you're up against a hard stop because the Ohio's run out of life, right? And there's not much you can do in terms of extending reactor life or hull life. And at the same time, the more this program goes, the more it crowds out everything else that's both in the shipbuilding plan, but as well as other accounts. Where do you stand right now, and how do you win back schedule, and how do you win back cost, or conversely, right, speed things up and try to make some of these very, very hard targets the Navy has set?
No secret, we've used up some of the program margin, over the last year or so with the Columbia. I think what I would tell you is I think we've got probably, the best PEO program team managing that effort. Working with General Dynamics and Huntington Ingalls on this, and as we finish the design, we're making that transition into from design into construction, which is always a tough threshold to get through in a ship construction program. I think the good news is the maturity of the design is high, and so that piece will be fairly stable. Once they get into construction, hopefully things will stable out a little bit. But it'll be tough. I mean, they're going to have to fight every day to maintain the schedule on that program.
And let me ask you a last question. But both unmanned systems as well as directed energy weapons are priorities for the CNO. He's been trying to drive change on both of those. Congress is skeptical about the unmanned plan that the Navy has. And at the same time, there are those who want the Navy to go faster in terms of rail guns and directed energy, noting, for example, the Chinese have already fielded a rail gun, where the Navy has done decades of extraordinary work. And in fact, I think the Chinese gun bears more resemblance to what the Navy has been working on than I think anybody would like. At the end of the day, bring us up to speed on both the unmanned plan and what do you tell members of Congress to convince them that, hey, look, the Navy does have a very, very good plan when it comes to unmanned. And then what the roadmap needs to be to get better generations of weapons on ships, given that all of these new weapons are electrically driven and will often outstrip, right? I mean, it's not as easy to take a railgun and put it on a DDG-51, because then you need different power generation, you need different power storage. Walk us through what the vision and the roadmap is for both of those, given that there is some skepticism about the speed of fielding new weapons, but also what the unmanned plan is.
Yeah, so let me start with the unmanned plan. And I would just tell you, we're moving full speed ahead on unmanned capability, on both the surface and the undersea domains. And we've had some really good successes over the last several months on the unmanned side. As your audience knows, we just completed back in the October timeframe the transit of Overlord, right? The vessel from the Gulf Coast to the West Coast there, over 4,700 miles. 97% of that was in an unmanned configuration. So almost 4,600 of the 4,700 miles that it transited was in an unmanned, unattended configuration. And so, one of the technical challenges here is with the reliability and making sure that we have the reliability and the redundancy in the systems to be able to operate these things in a continuous unattended unmanned mode for an extended period of time. And so, we continue to kind of work to prove that that type of technology out. Now, there's still more work that needs to be done there, obviously, but I think we've had some pretty good successes there over the last several months. On the I'll call it the doctrine side, which is really that probably comes in two flavors, right? One is the campaign plan that is being developed right now on the OPNAV staff under OPNAV N9. They're building that campaign plan, and that's going through a couple of different iterations. I expect, you know, that'll become a little bit more firm here as we get, further into 2021. But, you know, my sense is that'll be a living document that will be continue to be modified and updated as we continue to advance the technology in the unmanned world. The other piece is the CONOPS and how we use these unmanned systems. And I think, that's being developed by the Surface Development Squadron out on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And, again, a living document that will continue to be refined as we have an opportunity to take these unmanned systems and utilize them, you know, in fleet battle experiments and through experimentation efforts and whatnot. And again, we learn, more how we can use them in an operational manner. On some of the directed energy weapons, again, we continue to make, I think, good progress. We'll need to continue to go faster. So we deployed a laser on the USS Portland here last year. We installed that back in 2019 timeframe on Portland out in San Diego. Conducted some fairly extensive shipboard and then at sea testing early in 2020. And, the ship is now deployed, right? So that's a, 150 kilowatt laser, separated. It's not integrated with the ship's combat systems, admittedly, but a very good weapon system, standalone weapon system. That's that really, we got some very, very good test results, with that and learned a lot from that. Okay. And then the next laser, we've already put started to install lasers on some of our DDG 51 class ships. The optical dazzling interdictor, Navy is the Odin laser that I think your audience is familiar with. So that's been installed, again, another standalone weapon system. But again, some good test results on that. And so that program is moving forward. And, we've got a plan to continue to install that on additional DDGs. And again, we're also working the concept of operations on how those systems will be employed. So again, making, I think, pretty good progress there. The next one, the high energy laser, which now we're starting to get into some of the higher power levels and whatnot, but still within the power construct, the architecture that we have on the DDGs, we'll start installing those on a DDG, hopefully later this year, I think is what our plan is. So, we'll continue, you kind of, again, seeing that evolutionary approach from, what we did on Ponce in the 5th Fleet AOR several years back to the laser that was installed on Portland here, a year or two ago, to the Odin lasers that we're putting on the DDG 51s now, and then eventually migrating up to at least the first generation of the Helios laser. So we're making good progress on that. On the railgun, this is something we'll just continue to work on. I think we've still got some work to do on this. We are as part of that whole effort there, working, high velocity, projectiles, that we can fire out of that gun. But, there's probably still a little bit more work to go on the rail gun, and we'll keep working on that.
And very last question, and very briefly, Bonhomme Richard is going to be decommissioned and scrapped. What's the plan, to, replace, that ship?
Yeah, regrettably, given the extent of the damage on there and the cost to rebuild it, the cost to rebuild the ship, the potential impact that it would have had to the build plans for other LHAs, the decision was made to decommission and then eventually scrap that ship. What the PEO and the program manager working with RDA are looking at is how do they accelerate you know, the current LHA production line, you know, either accelerate the schedules, maybe potentially bundle some of the contracts they have to help with moving that program forward. So there's a couple of different options that they're looking at to try to accelerate to bring, you know, that capability back into the fleet. Unfortunately, we lost the Bonhomme Richard. Now, she was just on the tail end of a very significant, modernization availability that really added the Joint Strike Fighter upgrades to that platform. So she was going to be a very effective ship coming out of that availability. But, you know, I guess on the flip side, the ship that will replace her, a brand new ship, albeit, you know, a few years down the road, the Joint Strike Fighter mods installed in the ship as she gets built. So, and then any upgrades that we add to that system. So that's really the plan is to try to accelerate the current build cycle that we have, and looking at doing that through different contracting actions or working with the shipyard to try to accelerate that.
Sir, thanks very much for being so generous with your time. We really appreciate it, and look forward to talking to you again on the other side of SNA. Have a great show.
Thank you, Vago. Thanks very much for your time.